welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guests today are Dr. David Baker, Vice President, Digital and Software at Luminous Computing, and John Min, Director of Field Application Engineering at Andes Technology Corporation. Good morning, Dave and John, and welcome to our podcast.
Good morning, Dan, and it's good to be here, and you are a rock star legend in this.
Good morning, Dan. Glad to be here today. It was a wonderful day in California.
It is. Great weather. So the first question, Dave, is what brought you to semiconductors, and why did you join Luminous?
Well, I hope this is an interesting answer. You have to understand, I've been in the business a very, very long time. When I started out as a kid, there was still a Control Data Corporation. My brother-in-law was an engineer at Control Data. When I was about 12 years old, I visited him, and he took me into the lab where they were building these warehouse-sized computers. They had floor-to-ceiling panels with all these blinking lights on them. And this kid at 12 years old said, "That is exactly what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to build machines like this." And that's exactly what I set out to do. And I've been doing it for just about 50 years. So it's a life dream for me to be here today. And it's been a life dream for me all along that way. What brought me to Luminous is I'm at a point in my career where I like to do fun and interesting things. And if it's not fun and interesting, then I kind of don't really want to do it. I tend to run to the fire. So my previous gig was all about building processors without clock trees, all self-timed asynchronous things. Nobody had really done that commercially. And so I took a run at that. This time somebody said to me, "Hey, we're going to use photons for all kinds of things, from computation to interconnect and everything else." And I said, "Great, I don't know anything about photons. I think I'll go play." So that's what brought me here, is it sounded fascinating, interesting, and hard.
Yeah, so I was reading up on Luminous, and you know, they say they're building the most powerful and scalable AI computer, supercomputer on Earth. That's a big statement. I mean, can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, happy to. So that is our actual goal, and we actually think we can do it. The thing that makes it possible is stuff that we announced a couple of weeks ago in some PR releases. But we have this massive compute system that is interconnected at the lowest levels by photonic links. These are ultra low power links. And you know, the cool thing about photonics is that I can run a bus, essentially a SerDes bus, quite far with no degradation in bandwidth. If you use like an HBM memory, you got about a quarter of a millimeter of run before you start losing performance away from your controller. But with photonic links, I can run a length of half a millimeter or 10 meters, and I don't have any degradation in bandwidth, and I have almost undetectable changes in latency. And that changes the game for computer architectures a lot. And so the real underlying key to what's different about what we're doing is our ability to make massive computer systems. So, you know, we're looking at memory systems that are in the petabytes. And so it just completely changes the game for how hard is it to, you know, to map models, how into machines, particularly AI training machines, how, you know, how big can models be, how realistic can they be. You know, we're taking a serious look at are we enabling, you know, human brain levels of neural networks. And we think that within a generation of where we are right now, that's kind of what we'll be doing. So I don't think it's hyperbole to say that we're going after the world's largest supercomputer for AI.
That's incredible. You know, I'm a computer guy too. I trained on the CDCs, the mainframes, but when I entered the industry, mini computers were the big thing. So I actually started with Data General. I worked in their fab, and supercomputers back then were the Cray, right?
That's right. Cray, CDC, those kind of things. So my first job out of college was working for Texas Instruments on one of those monsters to try to compete with Cray. And, TI stopped doing that, and they built, 9900s and 9900s, which is what I ultimately did for them. And, but man, warehouse sized computers were kind of cool. Now, of course, they're not even all of the compute power in your watch, if you have a smartphone, is represented in that room sized computer.
Yeah, I remember one of our mini computers hit 1 million instructions per second, one MIP, and we were celebrating, right? That won't get you much. That won't get you much anymore.
Well, we had those joyous days when I was at IBM on the on RISC systems there, the old original RT and the 801s. Man, they hit a megahertz. Of course, it was ECL and it was pretty high power for some of the 801 type stuff, and still pretty high power to get to a megahertz. But man, that was tall cotton.
Yep. So same question, John. What brought you to semiconductors, and why did you join Andes?
It was a funny story to get to semiconductors, but what I grew up wanted to be was Dr. Rudy Wells at $6 Million Man, make robotics to make people's lives better, to do the bionics. So I was into computers, and they mentioned TI. So I did my master's work working on TI DSPs, and found that the TI DSPs that just didn't have enough room for specialization to really make smooth prosthetics control. So I started working on microprocessors, making microprocessors better, optimized, and that's how I got into silicon, using CPUs and DSPs into more optimizing and making specialized DSPs. So I've been working on CPUs and DSPs my whole career, and last 20 years working with CPU IP companies, sort of veered away from bionics prosthesis, but the more in the control area. I've worked at many CPU IP companies, and as RISC-V came along, I worked at other RISC-V companies and thought Andes was doing some standard CPU plus has some extra technology to customize computing better for either data movement or the compute.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with Andes from my time in Hsinchu in Taiwan. In fact, your CEO is one of my favorite people to have tea with. He's just a brilliant man, and he's just so personable. He's a really great guy. He's one of my favorite CEOs. So it's not a surprise that Andes is now a worldwide leader, of embedded processor intellectual property. So it's been an amazing 16-plus year journey. So Dave, let me just start first with you. Was RISC-V part of the original Luminous business plan? Do you know?
It was not part of the original business plan, because the original business plan was using photonics for computation. But before I got here, which is almost 2 years ago, the company had selected RISC-V and was actively modeling in instruction set extensions for RISC-V for this plan for the AI training kind of modules. So I came here partly because they were working with RISC-V, and I had done things with RISC-V off and on, that asynchronous processor company that I worked for previously. We had a backroom project going to do an asynchronous version of RISC-V. So I really wanted to go work on something that was RISC-V based. So it made it very attractive for me to come here. But they had already selected that, just not at the original plan.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure they did a good survey and did diligence on all the other processors. I used to work for Viraj Logic, and we purchased ARC, the ARC processor. So I do have some experience in that realm. And then we were bought by Synopsys, of course, and the rest is history. But it's an interesting business to be in. And, being a computer guy and then going down to IP and at the processor level was a really good experience. RISC-V, I'm a big fan. It's a huge a source of traffic for SemiWiki. I get to see all the different sources. And, ARM was the biggest deal for a while. But right now, RISC-V is definitely the leader. And, it's just interesting to see, why people chose it and, what they're doing with it. But, John, I have a question for you. Andes is kind of an interesting story because they started out building their own processors, and then it seemed like overnight, but how did Andes ramp up its RISC-V process, RISC-V business so quickly?
Well, but Then I was at Arc too. I was a pre-IPO Arc engineer. That's how I got into IP business. But the how Andes got through was we had our own architecture, but our architecture in a way was a traditional RISC architecture, and we were innovating our own architecture. And when RISC-V came around, we were looking at moving to 64-bit architecture anyway. So we had studies going on, and RISC-V architecture is very close to more what we consider more traditional RISC architecture, simpler instructions, load store architecture. So it wasn't very hard to map our proprietary instruction set to RISC-V. We did that quickly and came out with a set of cores that really hit the sweet spot of where RISC-V was starting, which is deeply embedded, higher mid-range performance processors.
Let me jump in here for a second. I think you're not doing yourselves a good justice on this. You know, I've been working in IP processor space for a long time, and I competed 10 years ago against Andes when I was doing the Firefly IP cores for Green Hills. And Andes was very thoroughly kicking our behinds back then. And what they did is they had their own proprietary instruction set, which they sold very effectively for quite a long time, which caused them to develop some really good microarchitectures. When RISC-V became practical, it was easy for them to jack up the decoder, move it out of the way, and convert those microarchitectures to be RISC-V. And they were already well along the path of having very high performance, very well thought out microarchitectures for when they converted to RISC-V. The same is true for them in DSPs. You know, when you look at how DSP came to be in the RISC-V ISA, it was largely Andes that drove that, and it was largely on the basis of DSP microarchitectures they already had. You see the same thing happened with VPU. We'll talk about that some more in a few minutes.
Yeah, you know, with ARC, by the way, ARC is still a very successful technology through Synopsys. I still know people that are there, and they've done quite well with it. But I always viewed ARC processor as more of a DSP. I don't know if that's exactly true, but yeah, a lot of processors. And remember MIPS? I think, David, did you used to work for MIPS? I mean, MIPS was the first RISC CPU, I think, right?
Actually, the first RISC CPU was done at IBM.
IBM, yeah, that's right.
With the 801, but MIPS was the first non-IBM kind of commercial one, and quite successful over the years. I did work a lot on MIPS with Silicon Graphics guys and a few other places like that. So yeah, MIPS was very much a contender. ARC. ARC has had kind of a pretty good life. You know, it's not Tensilica, but it's had a pretty good life and now ended up at Synopsys, and it's used a lot in Synopsys. You lift the lid on almost any of their SerDes IP, and you're going to find ARC cores running around under there. And I think there was a time when there were ARC cores running around in Intel processor chips doing, you know, housekeeping and cleanups and stuff like that. So you found ARC in a lot of interesting and very quiet places.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the internals of RISC. You know, as you mentioned, David, there's other reasons why people are using the RISC processor. So specifically, you know, what about the vector extensions? You know, how do they contribute to you guys choosing RISC-V and you guys succeeding in your business?
So I'm going to say a couple heretical things about RISC-V and about the RISC-V vector instruction set. Definitely we are using it. Definitely we think that it's the best launching point for what we're trying to do. But let me say, first of all, the RISC-V ISA is too risky. It is too reduced instruction. You know, yeah, it's what we're all going to use, and we're all going to use it together because it's a collaborative thing. But when you look at that ISA, and it's so load store specific that it doesn't even have auto increment loads and stores, that's gone too far, in my opinion. There is some other things about instruction compression that were not really comprehended in the group development of the ISA, but it is what we have to work with today, and it's a blessing that we have it. So While I can throw a few critiques at the instruction set, I'm a fan. I'm a proponent of it, and largely it's because it's an open source community, and it has all the benefits that a Linux has in the open source community. So I do throw a couple of onions at it, but really we're using it. When it comes to the vector instruction set, the vector instruction set is weak in a lot of areas as well. Partly because it was a committee design. But again, it's the best thing we have to work with out there, and it is not bad. When it comes to finding an off-the-shelf supplier of IP who has ready-made microarchitectures that have been pretty well drilled, it's actually a good place to be right now in the world we live in. So I'm hoping that we make some improvements over time in the vector architecture, but as a SIMD machine, as a vector SIMD machine, the VPU's instruction set is good enough, and that's really all it needs to be. And Andy's implementation of it is very good because it's built on solid foundation of work that they've already done. So yeah, going to the VPU was a way to do what we need to do for AI. AI, at the end of the day, is a DSP problem. And John and I have talked about this before in public forums. When you look at what has to be done for training, almost everything that's done in there is a DSP problem. It's not a CPU problem. And we see that with GPUs being applied to it and TPUs being applied to it, that at the end of the day, all of the algorithms that you need to implement for being successful at AI training are either general matrix multiply or something that is very DSP specific. Well, the VPU is a pretty good answer to DSP. The problems we have today with VPU2 is a microarchitectural position as well. The issue rate for instructions for VPUs, microarchitectures, is low compared to a DSP. I've done a lot of VLIW DSPs over the years, and one of the things that happens in those kinds of DSPs is IPC counts that are quite high. We don't see that in the microarchitectures. It's not the VPU instruction set's fault. We just don't see it in those architectures. So my bet on Andy's is that they will, continue the development of their microarchitectures, and we will continue to have a long and happy relationship with them supplying the IPs that we need for processing.
Interesting. So, John, how much did the availability of custom extensions contribute to the success of this project and the success of Andy's?
Well, I think that's a big differentiator for Andy's, and it is continuing to help us proliferate our cores, especially in the AI space. As Dave said, the AI is a DSP problem, not a CPU problem. And as a DSP problem, compute is the sort of easier part. Our custom extensions, so we could do compute, and we could also do data movement. So to feed that hungry data crunching engine, we could create custom ports to improve the data I/O so that you could really compute and minimize the stalls. And that gives us a differentiator in the vector engine. To really get the maximum performance per every square in the millimeter.
Have a comment on that, Dave?
I would love to comment on that. So John's right about everything he said. So here's the deficiency in the VPU as it's defined. Take an operator from TensorFlow like addV2. This is a simple dyadic operator. I got these two long vectors, element by element. I just want to add them up. So I have to load one from column A, one from column B. I've got to add them together, and I've got to write them out, on a store process. So I've got load op store as a software pipeline. That's what I have to do. But what happens with the VPU instruction stream, as defined, is there's not enough load bandwidth to do that. So there's not enough operator capability to do two load streams, a store stream and an operate stream together. What we're finding without ACE is that Operators like ADV2 are memory bandwidth limited because we can't load enough into the register file. What's really cool about ACE, you know, ACE has a lot of capabilities for adding your own instructions, and that may or may not be very useful going forward. Maybe it's a 2% or 3% kind of improver. What's really the improver is the ACE streaming port. So, and the reason that we're, one of the main reasons that we're using Andy's implementation of the vector instruction set is that ACE streaming port. That gives us a second port into the register file so that we can double our load performance in these DSP operations. And so, yeah, I really think the ACE is the reason Andy's is getting a lot of traction. And surprisingly enough, I don't think it's the instruction, unique instruction additions that's really, really doing it. I think it's the improved register file write port access.
Interesting. We're coming to the end. Final comments, either fellow?
Well, the one thing I'll say is it's Dave and his team have been the model customers work with. They give you right amount of feedback, both constructive and constructive feedback. So it's been a pleasure to work with, and they've given us good feedback so that we can continue to innovate on both the RISC-V CPU space, vector space, and the custom extension space. I look forward to working with him for a long time.
Well, and I will say that one of the things that we've enjoyed about working with Andy's is the collaboration that we get with him. So we have a problem tuning something, we can throw the problem up with Andy's team, and they will work it on their end and try to come up with the best optimizations they can think of. We will look at potentially, you know, ACE instructions or ACE port kind of streaming operations. And it's a lot of very detailed collaboration. I'm not sure you would get that with other suppliers.
I agree. Well, thank you, Dave, and thank you, John, and thank you all of our listeners for participating in the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series, and we'll see you again next week.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, guys.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.